there's not necessarily a link between how many wolves are seen in the park and how many are there.
A dispute over wolf numbers in Denali National Park. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, November 27th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, packing up the essentials for the start of the World Cup race season.
When all else fails, eat peanut butter. And you can buy it some places in Europe, but it's just not the same. It doesn't taste the same.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. Many Alaska business owners are paying too much for energy. The Commercial Building Energy Audit Program identifies an average of 30% in energy savings. The application period runs November 1st through December 20th. To learn more, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
Environmental groups are asking the state and federal government to exchange or purchase land to create a permanent wildlife buffer along the eastern border of Denali National Park. The request comes in response to a Park Service study that shows a decline in the number of wolves viewed by visitors who ride the bus along the park road. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
5,841. That's the number of bus trips along the road inside Denali National Park this summer. The Park Service sampled less than 1.5% of those trips to find out how often visitors spot wildlife. Wolves, in particular, were only sighted on 3 occasions out of 80 trips sampled. Don Stryker is Denali National Park superintendent. He says wildlife viewing is something visitors have come to expect.
I think the ability to experience wolves in the wilderness, sort of on their own terms, is an amazing and oftentimes transformative experience for people.
Wolves that have been spotted along the Denali Park Road in the past are likely members of the Grant Creek Pack.
The Grant Creek Pack breeds right near the road, and so they offer the best opportunity. They offered the best opportunity for people to be able to see those wolves. They sort of grew up with buses going by.
But in May of 2012, the Park Service reported the pack's dispersal. A breeding female was trapped and killed that year. Stryker says the loss of the pack means there are fewer wolves to spot in the area. But he doesn't think those numbers are an indicator of larger changes in overall population.
In no way, shape, or form would I suggest that this data suggests that we have a problem with respect to the viability of the wolf population in Denali.
There's not necessarily a link between how many wolves are seen in the park and how many are there.
Kathy Harms is a wildlife biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. For the most part, she and Don Stryker agree.
A specific wolf taken by a trapper was the breeding female in a pack commonly viewed, and it did disrupt viewing, but it didn't affect overall wolf numbers in the park.
But environmental groups argue hunting and trapping outside the park is affecting the population inside the boundary. Last spring, the Park Service counted 55 wolves, down from 143 in 2007. It's the lowest count since the park started keeping track of wolves in 1986. Rick Steiner is a conservation biologist and wolf advocate.
Now, we don't know all the causes to the decline, but without question, it's indisputable that take of park wolves when they cross the invisible boundary of the park on the east side, trapping and hunting, has contributed, and I think is the primary contributor to the decline in park wolves and certainly in viewing success.
In 2010, the Board of Game voted to eliminate a buffer zone that protected wolves that crossed the northeastern park boundary. Since then, Steiner and others have made multiple efforts to reinstate the buffer without success. But Kathy Harms says harvest numbers in the area where the buffer used to exist are too low to significantly impact the population.
In the formerly known as the buffer zone in the Stampede Trail area, the maximum number of wolves taken per year in the last 6 years has been 4 wolves, and often it's 0 to 2. So there's no correlation between trapper harvest and a decline in wolf numbers in the park.
In a letter to U.S. Department of Interior Secretary Sally Jewell and Alaska Governor Sean Parnell, Rick Steiner has requested the state and federal government negotiate an easement exchange or land purchase to secure a permanent buffer to protect Denali area wolves. Neither office has responded, but the governor's staff is reviewing the document. The Park Service is still compiling numbers from this year's fall wolf counts. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Bilge water is the nasty stuff that collects at the bottom of a boat. It can contain engine oil and antifreeze, and releasing it in state waters is illegal. But even though it's a crime, the state doesn't get too many chances to prosecute it. Last week, the Department of Law scored a rare legal victory when a bilge water case was decided in their favor. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
When someone dumps their bilge water, it's hard to nab the perpetrator. The evidence literally dilutes as the crime is happening. Unless, of course, the evidence freezes. That's exactly what happened in Seward 2 years ago. State Attorney Carol Hawley explains.
Seward Boat Harbor employees found an oily sheen around the edges of the vessel. And the reason why this was so easily determined is because there had been a hard freeze in the night that sealed the vessel up in ice.
The boat was the motor vessel Dutch Harbor, and the man operating it was Alan McCarty. While there's no way to get an exact amount of bilge water released, estimates put it at 200 gallons. To prove McCarty was responsible for the pollution, the state's Environmental Crimes Unit teamed up with the Coast Guard. They took samples of the contaminated harbor water and of the bilge water still on the boat. Then they compared them to see if they shared a similar composition.
What they determined when they sent it to the U.S. Coast Guard's laboratory in Connecticut was that there was a match.
McCarty was charged with unlawful discharge of oil, water pollution, and failure to report the release of hazardous substances. Last week, a jury found him guilty of all three counts. McCarty was fined $5,000, required to pay for the cost of the cleanup, and ordered to complete 50 hours of community service. As the state's environmental crime attorney, Hawley says that part of why the state prosecuted the case was deterrence. There have been situations, like in Kodiak a couple years ago, where bilge dumps were identified, but the offending vessel was never found. And if enough people get away with discharging bilge water in a given area, it can have a real environmental impact.
When you multiply it by, 100 Mr. McCarty's, you have a lot of toxic material that's being put into the water.
McCarty's attorney was also struck by how uncommon prosecution of this sort of crime is, but for different reasons. Paul Stockler says he can't think of anyone who's been in state court over bilge water violations. The most similar trial he can come up with is that of Captain Joe Hazelwood over the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Stockler disagrees with the court's decision and is preparing to appeal it. He says his client was prosecuted for something he didn't do. Stockler is also skeptical of the state's evidence against McCarty.
The person testified from back east that it was a match, whatever that means. So he's saying that the substance in the water is consistent with the substance in the bilge, but I think their science is lacking.
Hawley's confident in the test results, but says it is McCarty's legal right to appeal. And in the meantime, she hopes that future violators think twice about dumping their bilge. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
A state court judge says he'll personally review further procedures by the State Department of Natural Resources in a dispute over a water rights application. At a hearing today, Superior Court Judge Mark Rindner gave DNR a time frame for moving forward on processing the Chewitna Citizen Coalition's application for an in-stream flow permit. Last month, Judge Rindner told DNR the agency's delay in processing the 2009 application was unreasonable and violated the coalition's constitutional right to due process. At that time, Rindner gave DNR 30 days to get started. At today's hearing, the court set a schedule for DNR to take the first step in adjudication of the permit. Valerie Brown, an attorney with Trustees for Alaska representing the coalition, says publishing notice of the application is the first step under state regulations.
And DNR didn't do that. They sent a letter asking for a point of contact.
So today the hearing was about whether or not they had to immediately publish notice, and the judge said he was going to let them collect 60 more days of information before he decides if they have to publish notice or not.
Earlier, Brown had filed a contempt of court motion against DNR, while the state agency filed a counter motion for clarification. Judge did not find DNR in contempt of court. State Attorney Colleen Moore says a letter DNR sent to the coalition this month suggested further information is needed. Moore declined to be recorded, but said the state agency has until December 6 to formally request further information from the coalition, which then has 60 days to answer. A second court hearing is set for early February. The coalition wants an in-stream flow permit for a salmon stream in the Chewitna River watershed, which it says will be damaged if a proposed coal mine in the area becomes reality. Attorney Brown.
The fact that the judge is not going to allow DNR to continue to delay is a very good thing for us because we've been waiting a long time for this, and Chewitna Citizens Coalition would really like to secure fish protection with this in-stream flow application.
State Attorney Moore says the agency is not reluctant to process the coalition's application and that DNR's problem is a lack of staff time to process all applications in a timely manner. Moore says at this time more than 300 in-stream flow reservations are pending at the agency, most of them from other state agencies, although about 30 of them have been filed by private citizens groups. HB 77, legislation pending in the Senate Rules Committee, proposes to limit water reservation permits to only public entities, excluding citizen requests. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, putting together a Thanksgiving feast for Alaskans who can't afford their own.
Green beans, apples, peas, corn, stuffing, butter, potatoes, apples, turkeys.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnick Arm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Mat-Su Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and north slope. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Seward Ship's dry dock was only supposed to spend a few months fixing up the Tustamina ferry. Instead, it took them a year to finish extensive repairs on the 50-year-old vessel. As KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, the shipyard is now seeking millions of dollars in extra payment from the state of Alaska.
A few days before the Tustamina ferry finally returned to service in western Alaska, the shipyard that fixed it up filed a $4 million claim against the Alaska Marine Highway System. The state's original contract with Seward Ship's dry dock was for $6.2 million. Doug Corrette is the construction attorney who helped put the claim together.
The state added a significant amount of work to the contract that wasn't contemplated when Seward Ship's took on the job.
The shipyard didn't set up the scope of work on the construction project. Instead, the state hired an outside firm to design it. According to the claim, the designer got help from three other consultants. Corrette says the plans they produced were garbled.
The drawings and technical specification information that Seward Ship's received from the state and the state's designers to perform the work was both lacking in detail, lacking in accuracy.
The shipyard alleges that bad blueprints resulted in lots of changes to the project. According to the claim, the shipyard got 119 change orders from the state of Alaska. They included big projects like installing new propulsion controls, upgrading computer systems, and replacing a large amount of steelwork on the ship's hull. When it came time to check that work, Corrette, the lawyer, says inspectors used different standards for assessing quality than what the shipyard had agreed to. For welding, all the Coast Guard needed to do was perform a visual inspection.
For reasons that are still a little bit unclear, the Coast Guard decided that it wanted to kind of reinspect and actually x-ray some of the welds.
Based on their findings, Corrette says the Coast Guard ordered the shipyard to tear out welds on the steelwork and replace them.
And that cost them somewhere in the ballpark of $800,000.
Corrette says it also took a lot of time. The shipyard did get two contract extensions, giving them 90 extra days to finish up their work. And in the end, they blew through their extended deadlines, too. According to their original contract, the state could withhold $20,000 from the shipyard for every day they were late, up to $600,000. Corrett says the state is planning to withhold that full amount, and as part of their claim, the shipyard's asking for it back. Dana Burke is a litigator in the Attorney General's office. He's handling the Tustamina case for the Alaska Marine Highway System, and he says he's busy gathering documents and sharing files with the shipyard's attorneys right now. Once they're done with that, Burke says the state has 90 days to make a formal response to the claim. And even though they dispute Seward Ship's account, Burke says,
that doesn't mean it's an irreconcilable claim, and it doesn't mean that we don't look forward to trying to work through the claim with the opposition, and I look forward to doing that and to defending the case as necessary.
Speaking on behalf of the shipyard, Corrett says he's looking forward to resolving the claim too. The issue doesn't have to go to court, he says, and the shipyard is hoping to resolve the dispute before it gets that far. In On Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
The first World Cup event of the season in cross-country skiing is scheduled to start this Friday in northern Finland. Four Alaska Pacific University skiers will race, Keegan Randall, Holly Brooks, Sadie Bjornsson, and Rosie Brennan. This will be an eventful season for the team, building up to the Winter Olympics in Sochi, Russia, in February. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Holly Brooks kneels on the floor of her living room and digs into a grocery bag.
I picked up a bunch of things that I really like to have on the road. One is cheap American peanut butter.
Brooks also has a Costco-sized bottle of Cholula to stuff into her World Cup bag, along with everything else she needs for the next 4 months. 4 years ago, Brooks was a World Cup newbie, but now she is familiar with the routine of living on the road in Europe for months at a time. She says she's ready to start racing.
This time of year, it's like this mixture of excitement and anxiousness and a little bit of stress and everything all rolled into one.
Brooks' teammate, Keegan Randall, feels the same way.
It just helps to kind of get there, start focusing on the things you need to do to kind of get ready for each race. It's just kind of like all of a sudden you get to go into autopilot once you get there. So there's always anxiousness. You always have those butterflies in your stomach, but once you get over there and kind of get in the routine, then I think it just starts, it always gets better and better for me.
Randall is starting off this season as the world champion. If that isn't enough pressure, she's the clear favorite to win gold in the skate sprint in Sochi. But Randall has proven again and again that she thrives under intense pressure. And she says she feels like her whole career has been heading in one direction, up.
Well, we've definitely built the season around the best performance at the Olympics, and the World Cup is basically a bunch of dress rehearsals leading into the Olympics. So the World Cup is still, I mean, we train 6 months of the year to get ready for the race season. If it was only about the Olympics, that would be riding an awful lot on a couple races. So I'm excited about the World Cup, and I've definitely, you know, hoped to perform well all season, but with the best performance coming at the Olympics.
Randall is a veteran on the World Cup and is preparing for her fourth Olympics. On the other hand, her APU teammate, Sadie Bjornsson, is getting ready for her first full season on the World Cup, along with her first Christmas away from home. Last season, Bjornsson was plagued by injuries. She says she's looking forward to seeing what she can do this year.
I'm really excited to just see what can happen racing weekend after weekend, you know, having ups and downs, but knowing that you have a whole season ahead of you to, you know, have a better or worse result, you know, so that'll be nice.
APU head coach Eric Flora designed the training program that has quickly vaulted the APU women's team into the international spotlight. He says most of the difficult work of preparing for the season is over now, and he expects his skiers to do really well.
You know, there's still a lot of training from here to the Olympics, but the bulk of the training is done. Now it's time to kind of like refine and hone race skills and kind of get into the racing groove.
Flora says 4 years ago, the U.S. women's cross-country team basically had no chance to bring home an Olympic medal from Vancouver. This February, though, in Sochi, the team could medal in at least three races. Holly Brooks is looking forward to the challenge.
Something really exciting is going to happen, and, you know, there are all kinds of possibilities of what that could be, and you know, we're going to have some stories when we come back to Anchorage at the end of March, and we look forward to making everyone here in Alaska proud.
The season's first World Cup gets underway Friday in Finland with a women's sprint race and runs through the weekend. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Over 6,000 Alaskans are living with Alzheimer's or related dementia. November is National Family Caregivers Month and Alzheimer's Awareness Month. If you're caring for an elderly, chronically ill, or disabled family member, there are resources to help you and your loved ones. For information, visit Alzheimer's Resource of Alaska at alzalaska.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Aging and the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority.
The Thanksgiving season is known in America for its big family meals. For many people in South Central, that meal is able to happen because of the generosity of a number of individuals and organizations. KTNA's Philip Manning was at the Upper Susitna Food Pantry's Thanksgiving Blessing event and has this report.
Green beans, apples, peas, corn, stuffing, butter, potatoes, apples, turkeys, and all kind of little homemade cakes and cookies and anything you'd need for a Thanksgiving dinner.
That's Upper Susitna Food Pantry Director Shirley Lingero describing what was on offer at the Upper Susitna Senior Center on Saturday afternoon. The Thanksgiving Blessing event is one of two major holiday food distributions. The second will happen next month in preparation for Christmas. Shirley Lingero says that hundreds of people will have Thanksgiving dinner thanks to the collaborative event.
We're expecting at least 150, but I checked the list a few minutes ago, and 150 is what I typed up, and we have added like 20 more to that. Now, that's just us here. I don't know how many Trapper Creek is going to serve. I would imagine 50 to 100 up there.
Distributing that many baskets means a lot of food. Volunteer Dave Ward talked turkey with me. He said that the Upper Susitna Food Pantry was distributing over 2 tons of food, about half of which was the traditional bird. In order to get that food to the families that needed it, over 30 volunteers turned out, including many students. In addition to the volunteers who signed up, Shirley Lingero said some arrived on the day ready to help.
We have been so blessed this year with volunteers. Matter of fact, I sent some of them home earlier because we just had so many of them here, and they said they'd come back this afternoon and help break up.
The Upper Susitna event was just one of half a dozen Thanksgiving blessing distributions on Saturday. In all, the Food Bank of Alaska says that 1,963 baskets were given out in the valley. Executive Director Mike Miller was at Talkeetna's distribution and says it's good for him and his staff to attend the local events.
You know, on a day-to-day basis, we work with 25 partner agencies in the Valley and soup kitchens and pantries, but we're usually one step removed. You know, we're helping the people who are helping the people. And this is an event where we get to go out and you know, see things going on firsthand and work with the folks who are doing it. It's really grounding and it just really brings it back to why we're here. It's because there are people in our communities that are dealing with hunger on a daily basis.
The Anchorage Thanksgiving Blessing was held on Monday, and Mike Miller says the number of families who received baskets is up from last year.
We had a total of 8,038, which is right in the range we were kind of expecting. That's up from 7,497 from the year before, so about a 7% increase.
Assuming an average of a 15-pound turkey per basket, that means over 75 tons of poultry alone. Mike Miller says a project of that scale requires a massive undertaking and a lot of help.
It's an amazing amount of effort for food bank staff, for literally hundreds of volunteers, dozens of agencies, dozens of businesses who either donate, you know, money, turkey, time. It's really a huge community-wide event.
Listing all of the partner groups would not fit into this story, since Mike Miller says there are over 300 of them. The volunteers, both in the Valley and Anchorage, are already gearing up for next month's events. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
Gathering ingredients for a Thanksgiving feast may seem daunting, even for folks living on the road system. But things are even more challenging if you live in a remote village with no stores. Carluck is a community with less than 50 people on the west side of Kodiak Island. KMXT student news intern Marina Comiskey recently visited the village and found out what Thanksgiving preparation is like there.
Carluck has no local store, and all of the residents' groceries have to be ordered from shops in Kodiak and then flown in by small planes. This way of getting groceries proves to be more complicated and a little more expensive around the holidays.
The dry goods we have mailed out, so it's just postal rate. But anything that's cold or frozen, we have to have shipped out at 92 cents a pound.
That's Russ Scotter, a teacher at the Carlick School, who's been living there for 7 years. Scotter celebrates Thanksgiving, and his traditional dinner includes a turkey, albeit an expensive one.
We have to have it sent, we put an order in to Safeway, and then they have to fly it out. And because it's a frozen turkey usually, it comes on the plane, so then we pay 90 some cents a pound just to get it out here too. If it's let's say a 12 pound turkey, because that's what usually we get, it's going to cost over $8 just for the freight of the turkey.
Ronnie Lind, a longtime Carlick resident, also celebrates Thanksgiving with his family.
So you get a turkey, and I understand you have to order it from Safeway and fly it here?
Yes.
So if you don't mind my asking, how much is the cost of flying it here, do you know?
The cost of the turkey is probably around the price that everybody pays for it in Kodiak.
Right.
And then we most likely, with the stuffing, get... It's no less than the total freight cost is probably over $100.
Other villages on Kodiak also get turkeys sent out for Thanksgiving. April Carlo, the assistant manager at Island Air, said there are more flights for people going out to visit their families for the holiday, and she sees a rise in grocery orders around this time of year. Carlo also said because the turkeys that are ordered are frozen, the shipping prices would be a little higher than usual.
It just depends. You know, if it was just one turkey, then it would be $24 to any one of the villages.
Kodiak Area Native Association, or CANA, used to run a program to send turkeys out to the village elders during Thanksgiving, and Island Air brought them out. This program is not running this year, but a CANA spokesperson said they hope to bring it back in the future. I'm Marina Kaminsky.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, and Marina Kaminsky in Carlick. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. The Older Persons Action Group, publisher of Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide newspaper for older Alaskans and their families, can be read online at SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline is ready to help you succeed in your decision to quit tobacco. Take advantage of proven successful free resources. Trained quit coaches will provide support services to help you quit for good with confidential counseling. There's free nicotine replacement therapy and a tailored quit plan just for you. For more information, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitline.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance. Many Alaska business owners are paying too much for energy. The Commercial Building Energy Audit Program identifies an average of 30% in energy savings. The application period runs November 1st through December 20th. To learn more, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.